Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, my name is John Baker. I am here on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, Julie Stevens Long. This case is an FMLA retaliation lawsuit. The district court granted summary judgment at the end of discovery. The primary issue we have brought on appeal here today is this court and several of the other circuits' cat's paw rule and what that means and what it should mean. The district court, in deciding this case, decided that in order for the cat's paw rule to apply, the employee who makes the recommendation or who causes the termination must exercise singular influence over the decision. In other words, the decision maker must effectively have no say-so whatsoever, and that there is only this singular influence.
This question only comes into play if we have this retaliatory animus from the lower level individual providing the information. And what I'm curious about is that the district court judge found this retaliatory animus, or gave the benefit of the doubt of the retaliatory animus to the supervisor based upon a comment that he was frustrated with the loss or her number of days of absence. Is that correct?
Well, actually, I believe that there were about four separate comments that we have cited. It wasn't just one offhand
comment.
And
when were those comments made specifically?
One of the comments was made about 3 weeks before she was terminated. All of the comments were made during the FMLA period between September and when she was ultimately terminated in February.
See, I'm not sure the record reflects that. The first comments that he made regarding his frustration occurred in early September, and she was not even instructed on how to file for FMLA relief until the end of September, and then early October is when the filing comes into play, which is critical, of course, as to the cat's paw theory, as to whether he is, in fact, having animus based upon her time off for tennis elbow or the other medical conditions that she stressed.
Well, Judge Kendall, I think that there is a memo that was drafted by Mr. Branham, and it references a number of dates. And it says, the memo, and this is in our supplemental appendix, it's SA 69. Now, there's not a date on which the memo was drafted, but the entries into that particular document reference a date of 11-29-05, 12-6-05, 12-23-05, and 1-6-2006. So here you have Mr. Branham referencing the problems that her absenteeism has had, and these problems are all very clearly that he references in this particular memo are all very, very clearly within the FMLA time frame while she was actually on FMLA. So the statements, and one of the statements by Mr. Branham was made during the course of his deposition. He said, yeah, her absences created problems within the work environment. And I think that's true. I mean, but I think that's a practical problem that is associated with the FMLA. When an employee is on intermittent leave, it is going to create problems for the employer.
Well, and she had problems long before she invoked, right? She was missing 25% of her days before she ever invoked in fall of 05, correct?
That is correct. The reality is they didn't discipline her at all during that period of time for that, okay? And what we have to understand is those absences were excused absences. This is a 20-year career employee who had built up significant amounts of sick time, vacation time. There was also compensation time. You know, when she worked overtime, she would be allowed to take hours off for that. So were there periods of time that she was off? Yes. She had some issues at that time. She had an elbow problem. She was being heavily medicated with narcotics. And so her doctor said she should take it off. And she did. These ovarian cysts started to occur in the early fall. At that point in time, she spoke to the human resources officials at TRS, and that's when she went on the leave of absence. But I think, Judge Kendall, you raise a good point, because it seems as though what TRS is saying, no, it's not the FMLA absences that led Mr. Branham to make these statements. It's the previous absences that led him to make this statement, or non-FMLA absences that led him to make this statement. Well, the problem with that is, it seems to me as though that's a question of fact. You know, what was he make? Why was he making those statements? And what absences did they rely upon?
Well, the judge gave you that issue. So right now, the question then goes back to your opening, which is whether that singular influence of that supervisor's opinion influenced the decision maker here. And he also found that there were at least three other individuals who provided information.
Which is... I don't think correct, and I think that you can read through our brief, and it will fully explain that. But if you look through, you will notice that the person who made the recommendation was Julie's immediate supervisor, a man by the name of Marshall Branham. Marshall Branham made the recommendation, and ultimately that recommendation was carried through. The person who made the decision is a man named John Bauman. Mr. Bauman is in charge of the entire pension system for teachers in the state of Illinois. He is a very busy man. He stated that he talked to two separate people, Gina Larkin and Marshall Branham. Gina Larkin was the human resources representative. Now, what they have claimed and what the district court says is that the cat's paw theory is broken because Gina Larkin herself did this thorough analysis and thorough investigation. The problem is there was no thorough investigation that was ever done. My client was never even talked to. The employees who supposedly complained were never talked to. The individuals who were these beneficiaries who complained were never talked to. Their names are unknown to anyone at this day. So there was no independent investigation. But I think it goes back to the rule on what the cat's paw analysis should be. And I think that what I have advocated is consistent with what this court has done when it has seriously looked at this issue and said, this is a typical tort causation type of issue. And that is, do the actions of the individual cause the end result? And in this case, without Mr. Branham coming forward and making the recommendations of termination, Julie Stevens Long isn't terminated. He's the one who makes the recommendation. He is the one who is pushing for it. Ultimately, the executive director approves it. But the executive director never spoke to my client. The executive director never looked at anything. He talked to two people, and only two people.
He also reviewed all of the payroll records, the payroll members' complaints, and he received various logs from one other individual, Sherman, before making the decision, right?
Sally Sherman testified that her opinions based on the performance of my client was based solely on what Mr. Branham told her. Sally Sherman was Mr. Branham's immediate supervisor. That's what she indicated she based her statements on. These logs or whatever that he relied upon, I don't know what they are because they don't seem to exist, or these things that he contends he relied upon. I mean, I think that in his testimony, he says, you know, did you rely on any input from anyone other than Gina Larkin in making that decision? And he says, I relied on the input from Terry Vire and Marshall Branham. And then he goes on to state, you know, I ask him what details were provided. Well, just that a check should have gone to a member or went to a store in another state. He references one specific instance, and this is Mr. Bauman's deposition, which is on page 14 in our appendix at page 4 and in our brief on page 33. And he said, you know, quote, I took the managers at their word. This is what Mr. Bauman said. So as far as this suggestion that Mr. Bauman somehow reviewed a number of documents, I don't believe that it's accurate, and I don't believe that that accurately reflects his testimony. I see that my warning light has come on, and if it's possible, I'd like to preserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
I have 30 entire seconds.
Thank you, Judge Easterbrook. Thank you, Judge Kennedy.
Mr. Sachs.
May it please the Court, Leonard Sachs for Teachers Retirement System in the State of Illinois. Teachers Retirement System, TRS, exists primarily for the purpose of providing seamless benefits to retired school teachers and their beneficiaries. And from as early as 2002, well before Ms. Long took her 17 days of FMLA leave and continuing throughout her tenure, her non-FMLA leave absences had a direct and adverse impact in this workplace. She was the sole person responsible for inputting sophisticated data, address files, changing bank routing numbers. She jealously guarded that power that she had. When her non-FMLA absences began interfering with TRS's obligations to its members and disrupting its organization, they directed her to cross-train other employees. They did that in 2004, in June. She hadn't done it as of the following year, in June of 2005. Again, in May of 2005, they instructed her to cross-train the data services staff, the people who actually do this type of inputting, so she'd have some backup. And this is the busy time of the season when school teachers get done with teaching for the semester. And you'll find that, you know, June, July, August, those summer months, are when the vast majority of new EFTs are processed through that office. And she missed, as you noted, 25% of the working days in June when they processed 1,526 new FTEs. Then the following month, they processed 1,216 new EFTEs, and she missed 40% of the working days. She was counseled. She was, in fact, on the 26th of July, denied a promotion that Mr. Branham had recommended she receive, and he withdrew that based on her absences, her unplanned, unscheduled absences. She totally agreed with his decision at that time. On September 15th, there was another counseling session. It's disputed whether Ms. Long received any documentation from it, but it's as a function of the affidavit being stricken, which we believe was properly done by the district court, that meeting took place, and that included addressing serious errors on the EFT processing, incorrect bank and member addresses. Other payroll staff were required to handle that.
Is this a meeting between Branham and the appellant?
That's correct.
Okay.
And if you look at the Ward declaration, she had still failed to, by mid-September, trained the data services folks that she was supposed to do. And she admits that our EFT system allows us to track who's inputting data and changing things for particular members. And Ms. Ward's declaration attaches computer screen print-offs and email messages and documents numerous complaints from sources both within TRS and from outside TRS. And those folks clearly break this singular influence, singular source for the information. Now, did Gina Larkin have to talk to all those folks individually? No. It's obvious from these records that are authenticated by Ms. Ward that problems were occurring and problems needed to be addressed. And all of these problems that are documented in their concern absences that were non-FMLA absences. And if you look at the document that Mr. Baker has addressed to the court, where it specifically references concerns or problems with absences caused by her being away from work, those are all non-FMLA absences. The singular influence issue in the Brewer analysis, here there's no falsification. There's absolutely no evidence that there's been falsification. Nothing's been manipulated. There's no allegation that there's been information withheld. There's no evidence whatsoever in the record of that. As far as the other singular influence issue that we sometimes see, there's no allegation here like you had where the mayor in the Hunt case was the unrepentant racist, and he had held some sway. And the example in the Wallace case, where you have a closely held corporation, a family business, and you know, junior may have some influence over a more senior decision maker. But we don't have those facts here. And the independent investigation that Gina Larkin did, she was in consultation with both Sherman and Branham throughout the procedure. Starting back in the summer of 2005, she met with them again in the fall, reviewed documentation, insisted that she be given all of the documentation before any final decision would be recommended to Mr. Bauman, the ultimate decision maker. She reviewed all of that documentation. She didn't need to go talk to any third parties or interview the plaintiff to get her version of the events. It was obvious, based on the business records maintained, that these were not FMLA-protected absences. There was no justification. She consulted with TRS in-house counsel specifically regarding the implications of the FMLA as to this particular leave of absence. And after that consultation, she made the recommendation to John Bonham to terminate the employment, and he agreed with that recommendation. The only direct contact that Mr. Bauman had with Mr. Branham concerned, and it's an admitted fact, member checks going to the wrong place. And these folks are in the business of getting money in the pockets of these retired teachers, and we had numerous instances where the wrong bank was getting it, or it went to a grocery store, or a hard check went instead of a direct deposit check, and as a result of that, checks may be bounced, or overcharge expenses were incurred, and an account was frozen. And all of this stuff gave rise, ultimately, to her termination. She was dropping off these EFT forms after she finally trained the data services folks at the very last minute before the key cutoff periods. And missed key dates immediately after dumping 122, she missed 11:30:05. On 1:19:06, Mr. Branham discovered 177 uncompleted forms on her desk. And February 1, 06, she dropped off 86. And the folks who had to input this and double-check it just, you know, were at wit's end because they didn't have adequate time to get this work performed. As far as the argument in the brief as to failure to follow the internal discipline policy, you'll note that that policy is a general policy couched in precatory language. It's not mandatory whatsoever. The oral warning provision in Section 4A provides that oral counseling is appropriate and may be repeated, or you can implement a more severe option. And it was repeated. She was repeatedly counseled on this issue. And it gives you the right to go to termination. The spirit of this is so that a supervisor or manager doesn't go terminating an employee without having a chain of command review. Because Gina Larkin was the person who ultimately had to recommend every discharge or suspension to John Bauman, clearly that was the intent of that policy, was satisfied by her active involvement all throughout this entire process. And so I really think that that argument fails for them. And for all those reasons, we would respectfully request you affirm the district court's judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sachs. Anything further, Mr. Baker?
I'm going to speak quickly because I only have 30 seconds. I would ask this court please to review the earlier court's decision in Lewis versus Blumenkamp, this court's decision from 2008. I think we have an identical situation here. He's wrong about the employee disciplinary policy, and I would ask that the court please review that at SA 51. It provides very clearly that she is to be given written documentation when there's a problem and that she is given an opportunity to correct that. That was never done here. There are no documents. They maintain there are all these mistakes. these documentation does not exist. It doesn't exist. Finally, the question of Mr. Bauman giving information to Gina Larkin, there is a dispute of fact. It's on page 82 through 84 of my client's deposition that is in the record as to her calling Mr. Bauman and telling him it was FMLA leave. So I thank the court, and I ask the court to reverse the decision of the trial court and allow us to have a trial.
Thank you very much. The case will be taken under advisement.